Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
A recent court case ruling in the UK means that children with gender dysphoria will not be allowed to undergo experimental and extreme treatment that involve things like puberty blockers and, for young girls, things like mastectomies. Earlier on in the week, I chatted to psychotherapist Stella O'Malley, where she told me a little bit more about the case and its implications.
This case was taken by two people. The first person was Kira Bell. She's 23. And she was a very vulnerable child. She came from a very difficult background. Her mother was an alcoholic and her father was very heavily religious, but he left the home. And so she had a hard time on her own when she was a kid. She was very gender nonconforming, what we would call a tomboy up until recently. And that was perfectly fine until she hit puberty, but she found puberty very difficult. She couldn't relate to the kind of pink, frilly, glittery girls around her. And she ended up stopping going to school and staying in her room and playing video games, found transgender issues online and decided that was the solution to all her problems. And because of the system that has come in the last 10 years or so, she was fast-tracked. And so at 15, she sought help. By 16, she was on puberty blockers. By 17, she was on testosterone. And by 20, she had removed her breasts. And so now she's 23 and she's reverted to living as a woman. She regrets it all. She thinks she was a kid who needed psychological help. And she has a man's voice. She has an Adam's apple. She has facial hair, body hair, mastectomy, and is very angry. And so she decided to take the case because she thinks it was inappropriate, the help that she got. As she says, all I needed was psychological help.
And just Stella, in this case and in Kira's case, was that the first port of call? In other words, kind of railroading her down this trajectory of that extreme intervention, the double mastectomy, all the things you've mentioned, or is any other kind of pathway presented?
That's the big issue. I'm a psychotherapist, and up until 10 years ago, without a doubt, all the other pathways would have been presented and used, such as psychological help, such as CBT, various different therapies that you could use, you know, body grounding exercises, so many different therapies. And a kind of an ideological kind of approach swept into hospitals. When I say the last 10 years, very much in the last 5 years. Well, I just want to say the second person is somebody who I have a lot of, concern and empathy for, insofar as she's the mother of a child who doesn't want her child to be down that medical treatment. She's a mother of a 15-year-old. She's called Mrs. A. She's the second claimant in this case. And she wants to stop her autistic child, who has a lot of other mental health diagnoses, from being given puberty blockers and medical treatment. So the courts decided, ultimately, they read thousands of pages, is the High Court, top judge in the UK, decided that it was not appropriate because children couldn't consent to treatment that would impact their sexual fulfillment in the future. It would impact the development of their sexual identity, and it would impact so many things that they couldn't consent to, that they just didn't have the concepts because they were too young. It impacts their fertility, so Kira doesn't know, and probably won't be able to have children. And so you can't. So the courts decided it was too heavy a weight to ask children to consent to something like that. And this really impacted Irish children, because up until the ruling, which happened on Tuesday, there were regular monthly clinics from GIDS, from the Gender Identity Development Service in London, coming over to Ireland to give medical treatment to Irish children, because the Irish hospitals felt that they couldn't give what they called was the high level of treatment that was available in London, in the Tavistock. What I have been arguing since I discovered about it in 2017, so far I've been arguing for 3 years, it's not. It's an experimental medical pathway. And now the courts, thankfully, have fallen exactly in with where I'm coming from, which is it's an experimental treatment pathway that is leading to a huge amount of distress. And they have pretty much all but banned it. They've certainly made it incredibly difficult for children to be able to access puberty blockers. You'd have to go to court. You'd have to kind of go through a lot of hoops to get it. And I think that's right, because I think there's some great treatments out there for distress. kids, and I don't think puberty blockers are them.
Keira Bell, you met recently, Stella, at a conference for detransitioners. Presumably she's not alone in this, that there's many others who have a similar experience to her.
No, she is not alone in it, and the numbers are very high. And one of the very many issues in this field is that a lot of academic inquiry, a lot of inquiry in general, such as the film I did for Channel 4 in 2018, has been shut down by trans activists. People have shut down people saying, surely there's other treatment pathways, which is what you said immediately. Is there other treatment pathways? What is the situation? And it's been shut down. So for example, you know, Dr. Lisa Lippman, she did a paper, and it was the trans activists got it taken off Brown University's website. There's been a lot of different activism that has stopped academic inquiry, and that's a big issue, and that's one of the reasons. Sorry, I forgot your question, but that's one of the reasons why.
Yeah, in other words, it's on this whole issue, there's very little room for debate and discussion, and especially when what we're talking about today is we're talking about children, essentially, and as you say, experimental treatment.
What you were saying, yeah, you were talking about the detransitioners. Yeah, I am a founding member of the International Association for Therapists of Desisters and Detransitioners, and the numbers are huge, and we don't know the numbers. The reason why we don't know the numbers is every attempt at academic inquiry to find the numbers of detransitioners has been shut down by activism. So we don't know. So I knew your question would be, how many are there? And I'm saying, there is a lot. There's more than I can handle. There's more than anybody in our association can handle. We're continuously trying to find new therapists who could actually work with detransitioners. Why? Because we're all full up. Because there are so many detransitioners out there. We don't have enough therapists to cope with them. And yet the academic inquiry that would have founded the services so that we could cope with them has been shut down.
In terms of what you do know, though, Stella, for those children or young people who don't get kind of railroaded down the puberty blocker path prior to this ruling, of course, do they grow out of gender dysphoria?
Up until recently, 80% of children who had gender dysphoria grew out of it. So long as they didn't have medical intervention, they grew out of it. Then with the arrival of puberty blockers, that number from 80% went down to 0 to 5% of children who get given puberty blockers grow out of it. It's a seismic change.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Earlier on in the week, I chatted to David Turner of The Church in Chains, where he was telling us a little bit about a story that you will unlikely have read about in the mainstream media. Once again, the issue of Christian persecution never receives the coverage it deserves. David started off by telling me a little bit about this brutal attack in Indonesia.
This is an attack that happened on a Salvation Army outpost in a very remote village. The village was called Lemban Tonggoa, and it's on the edge of the rainforest in the Indonesian island of Central Sulawesi. Now, in that area, there's been a terrorist group called the Eastern Indonesia Mujahideen, and that's been active for quite some time. It's very much like so many other Islamist terror groups. It wants to overthrow authorities and install Sharia law. So it's been attacking farmers in the area. It's also been attacking government forces when they try to engage with them. But on this particular occasion, they came to this village and they targeted a family that belonged to the Salvation Army. Many people, I think, will be familiar with the Salvation Army in this part of the world from its work in seeking to help the homeless do good to all who need it. And the Salvation Army in Indonesia is much the same. And it was working in this area where, there is a lot of poverty and a lot of need, seeking to do good. And these terrorists came in. They came in at breakfast time on a morning, and they killed four people from one family, as you mentioned. They also set fire to the building that the Salvation Army was using for worship. It was a small community, just 12 families, maybe 40 people in total. And that building was just destroyed. And as you said in your introduction, 750 people just had to flee the village as a result of the terror.
So there, it was a kind of an attack on so many fronts, David, but, you know, attacking an organisation that's trying to do good. Do you think one of the motivations was because of their Christian roots and the fact that there was worship being held in that place?
Yes, indeed. Indonesia, as I think many people know, is just a vast archipelago of so many islands, and many of them obviously remote from the central government. And in some of these regions, Islamist groups really have an iron hand, and they really just believe that the only people that should live in Indonesia are Muslims. It's an attitude we see maybe in India, which militants believe that should be just for Hindus. So it's a very exclusive approach, and I think they are often very much annoyed when they see Christian groups like the Salvation Army in this case active in the community, showing the love of Jesus in practical ways. And, you know, as I was thinking about this story, and it's, you know, it's a terrible story. It's a story of terror. It's a story of murder. I thought of two verses, one that we think of many times at Christmas time, the coming of the Lord Jesus, described as the light shining in the darkness, and the darkness has not put it out. And, you know, this is just an attack of darkness trying to snuff out the light and love of Jesus in Indonesia. And, you know, we'd encourage people to pray, people who are listening to us, to pray for all Christians in Indonesia as they continue to seek to shine out with the light of Jesus.
Yeah, that's a very important message for people listening today, David. As you've mentioned, this is an ongoing issue in Indonesia. What is actually being done about it?
Yes, well, the Indonesian government is aware of the activities of this Islamist group and others, and they are seeking to find out who carried out this attack and launching a full investigation. We are disappointed. We are disappointed, we have to say, with the fact that in public statements, the Indonesian government, perhaps like other governments, has been reluctant to actually state that this attack was religiously motivated. Many governments do not like to represent their country as having a cancer of, you know, religious persecution and anti-Christian militancy. So the government has, as some people have said, has whitewashed this attack. Yes, they are seeking to protect all Indonesians, as they should, but they're not willing to name the specific motivation in this attack, and we find that disappointing.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
One of our Christmas countdown guests this week was well-known celebrity chef and co-owner of restaurant 1826 in Adair. Wade Murphy started off chatting to me about one of his childhood Christmas memories.
I have so many. Like, my family are Christmas mad. Elaine doesn't get it sometimes. She's like, oh, you're crazy. Like, we'd want to put up the Christmas tree mid-October, you know, straight after Halloween and stuff. But I've so many great memories, but like, the excitement is one of them. Going to bed with your stocking at the end of the bed, and mom telling you to now go sleep now because Santa won't come unless you're asleep, and all this kind of stuff. So all that kind of stuff, and like, Elaine even thinks I'm crazy because I have to have new pajamas, new socks, new underwear, new blah blah, everything for Christmas night, and it's all under the tree Christmas tree and stuff. So all that kind of stuff it's really great memories. You know, the boxes of roses, the boxes of chocolate Kimberley under the tree. I remember the first year myself and Elaine were together, and I did that, and I came back from the shop, and I'd box of potato, box of roses, box of USA biscuits, blah blah. She's like, what's that for? And I said, oh well, like, they have to go under the tree. And she goes, and what's the story with them? We can't touch them till Christmas Day. She's like, oh Lord.
That was your first tradition that Elaine learned about, Wade.
Yeah. Like, we're building our own traditions now with Rean and stuff like that. So like, this year now, he's 2.5. a little bit older, loving the lights, loving the excitement, singing Santa Claus is Coming to Town and all that kind of stuff. So it's really great. Like, that brings back, apart from creating our own memories, like, it's bringing back childhood memories to me too about the whole excitement of it and that.
Because Rian's able to, probably at 2.5, able to kind of understand it a bit more and get more into the excitement.
A little bit more, yeah. Like, he goes crazy when we're driving from Adair to Ballingarry where we live, and he sees the lights and he's like, look at the lights. And, you know, so it's great, great.
It's lovely to see Christmas through the eyes of a child, just the wonder and the excitement. And as you say, it kind of brings you back to your childhood as well. And we definitely need that wonder and excitement now more
all
than
big
ever,
time,
for sure.
All big time.
Tell us about one highlight for you from 2020.
I suppose the biggest highlight is actually getting to spend so much time with Elaine and Rian that together as a family, that we would never have normally got if the restaurant was running normally, you know. The first lockdown, the second lockdown, being at home every day and spending time with him and watching him grow and things like that, and going for walks and all that. To me, that's the biggest silver lining in all of this. You know, even for his second birthday was on a Saturday in May, and, you know, we got the cake at home and we had it and we video called all the relatives and his grannies and all that kind of stuff. And if the restaurant would have been up and running as normal, there was no way Mum and Dad were going to be there together on a Saturday, like.
Yeah, and that time is something you're going to hold on to. What about a low light of 2020, Wade?
Oh, there's too many, to be honest. Not too many, but yeah, it's hard. It's hard to try to stay positive. I'd say the second lockdown was a lot harder than the first lockdown. It was a lot harder to take mentally. It was a lot harder to come to terms with, because, like, we'd made such an effort to get back open and do things right and socially distance and Perspex screens
and all the investment and time and
all that kind of stuff. We'd spent so much time, and then to be told you have to close. You know, if I was to close my doors because I'd ran the business wrong, and myself and Elaine had done something wrong, and we'd ran a bad business, if we were to close our doors for that, that would probably be a lot easier to accept than somebody else telling you have to shut down, even though you've done nothing wrong, you know. So that's probably one of the lowest points of 2020.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people will kind of echo in different ways, you know.
Yeah, like, everybody's story is different, but, you know, it's kind of the same thing now. Yeah, so to kind of mentally get around the second lockdown was very hard.
Yeah, and as you say, Wade, you don't want to see lockdown 3.0. Nobody wants to. Hopefully that won't be the case.
No, please God, no. We don't see that. Like,
what about a hope then for 2021?
I suppose the biggest hope is we get back to some kind of normality. We get back, you know, with the vaccine and everything. I know it's going to take time to roll it out, and I know it's going to take time for everybody to get it, and not everybody's pro vaccines and vaccinations and stuff. But I would kind of hope that, you know, that we would get back to some kind of normality. People can meet again, people can hug again, you know. I'm a very social kind of person and stuff like that, so I miss all of that, you know.
Yeah, and just, yeah, a bit of normality, I think, is something we're all craving.
Yeah, look, we've all been able to spend more family time and stuff like that than we normally would, which is a huge bonus. But also, it's we're a social type of person anyway, you know, so it's obviously very hard on a lot of people and things like that. So, you know, to get back to some kind of normality, and it'll probably never be the way things were, but, you know, if we get close to it, I that's my hope for next year.
Yeah, what about something you'd recommend for us to do this Christmas?
Well, this, you know what, you probably know, and if I was a betting man, you'd probably bet straight on, that I'm going to say to shop local, support the small businesses, support, you know, your small shops, or your community shops, everything like that. And then, you know, even just pick up the phone and call somebody that you haven't spoke to in ages and just say Happy Christmas, you know. You never know how much of a difference that might make to that person, what they're going through in their head and things like that, because it has been very mentally challenging for everybody.
Yeah, and I don't think we can kind of overstate the shop local message enough, and eat local and all that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah. Look, every euro that's spent locally, a large amount of that gets invested back in locally in small family-run businesses and stuff like that. And they're the ones that are struggling at the moment. But, you know, the SMEs and family-run businesses, they're the ones that are finding it really tough, and they're the ones that are trying to do the right thing by everybody. So a little bit of support over the Christmas period might help them carry through, because unfortunately, a lot of businesses that were closed down in these couple of lockdowns, they're open, but they might not be open this time next year.
Yeah, and that's the last thing we want to see. So, as you say, supporting those local businesses is a way to try and hopefully stop that from happening, at least for some businesses. Well, how are you going to be celebrating Christmas this year, Wade?
A nice quiet time at home. We're working right up until the 23rd of December. And then we're shut for 4 days and back open then. So nice quality time. Obviously, I'll be doing the cooking. Yeah, it's just going to be time at home, Christmas, building our own memories, building our own family memories and stuff like that.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Earlier on in the week, I chatted to nutritionist Alex Dobbs from Grassroots Nutrition, and she was giving us advice on trying to stay healthy over the Christmas season without being too much of a Grinch. So she started off giving advice on avoiding too much comfort eating at home.
Yeah, one thing this year, obviously, we don't have the Christmas parties, but I would say if you feel like you're missing out because you can't go out for a meal with your friends or, you know, colleagues, don't start comfort eating and say, oh yeah, I can afford to have that box of celebrations now because I'm not doing whatever else that I would normally be doing, because it's just the way it is this time of year. The pounds will creep on so quickly, and then come January we all feel very guilty. So I would say my best thing is, actually, if you have a tenner, you can get 3 punnets of berries for about 100 calories.
I was going to say you can get 3 boxes of sweets.
Yes, there you go, for thousands of calories. So choose wisely. You know, don't be afraid to spend a little bit of money on healthy sweets or sweet things like fruit, even dried fruit a little bit. But I think we've got such a good supply of fresh berries at the moment, melons, bananas, they're all delicious. Feast on those if you can.
Okay, and what about kids as well? Because it's no different for them that, you know, they see the treats. I have to say, Alex, I have been that mum who's hiding in the utility room sneaking a celebration into me. And it's almost like when you open the wrapper of a sweet that our children have this like supersonic hearing. What are you eating? What's going on? And the little feet come in. And it's monkey see, monkey do a lot of the time.
Of course, absolutely. And you know what? Maybe then, you know, I remember those days because I used to do it the same. But what you can do, though, is allow them or allow yourself a sweet every day. So I have an advent calendar, which is a big deal in Germany, where I'm from. So I put a little bit of chocolate into the advent calendar every day, and I sort of refer to that when they want more sweets during the day. And, you know, it's sort of tough love in a way, because they say, well, you have more sweets later on. Or just allow them a little bit. Allow yourself a little bit. One or two celebrations, as in not the box, but the individual chocolate, they won't do any harm. But, you know, measure how much you're going to take. Having said that, once that big box is in the house, it's very difficult to measure, isn't it? So, I don't know, if you can avoid it in the supermarket, don't even go near them. Walk straight past them and go and buy things like fruit, things you like, or even nice crackers and cheese, you know, just anything that isn't sugar, because the sugar keeps you wanting more.
Yeah, and that's the thing, it's so addictive. But it's interesting, Alex, just to hear that advice of, rather than being a total Grinch and having a little bit of balance, and say, like, for the Feast of St. Nicholas, we had, there's a tradition that some Christmas year they put little sweets in the stocking. And yeah, so there was one celebration shared between the two of them, and that was enough, you know. Yeah. But what about, how important is it to start the day, you know, in terms of a healthy breakfast? If you start the day right, is that half the battle?
Well, always. You know, if you can manage to eat some porridge or maybe some muesli or have a couple of eggs and toast, that's a really good way to start. And that's massively important. So, yes, you might have your chocolate. But that's the other thing is always make sure you don't skip meals because you've eaten chocolate or because you are eating chocolate later. Because you have to have the foundation of good food. And then you can add to that. So, for example, because we don't have that many after-school activities, I do try to bake cakes and things with my children, and we've done that all year long. So, you know, if you've prepared something yourself, you value it that much more, and, you know, you make it go maybe last for 3 days rather than eating the whole lot all at once. So maybe bake some cakes or biscuits, you know, with your children, or chocolate-covered strawberries, really easy. Melt a little bit of chocolate and just cover strawberries with it, and absolutely delicious, you know. And again, you've eaten a punnet of strawberries and maybe just a quarter, like 25 grams of chocolate, which isn't that much, you know.
But yes, and it's still getting that little bit of a treat. I find the little mini chocolate-covered rice cakes good sometimes, and I guess the kids only know what the treats that you give them, and that to them is enough of a treat. What about one of the things that people might struggle with this time of year, Alex, is, you know, when it's hot, warmer during the summer, and that you might be better at drinking your water, but when it's really cold, staying hydrated mightn't happen as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe cups of tea. So not always full cup tea, because obviously you can only drink so many of those cups a day, maybe two or three. But if you just have herbal teas, these days the supermarket shelves are stuffed with beautiful brands or own brand teas. Peppermint. I love peppermint and licorice, or there's a Manuka honey and I think lemon and ginger blend. So those I actually use, you're right, I use them to try to hydrate myself without drinking too much water and getting too cold, you know. But you know, the other thing I really feel is, if you can avoid eating those chocolates, like, you literally go to the fruit island, buy lots and lots of fruit, and remember that come January you feel that much better. It's also good for your immune system. All these fruits and vegetables, they have lots of vitamins that you need to keep your immune system going, whereas chocolates and sugar really weigh heavily on your immune system. And this year in particular, we really have to make sure that, you know, we are in top form when it comes to health.
The main question that I'm asked by my children is, can I have a snack? Can I have a snack? They've just had breakfast 10 minutes later. Can I have a snack? Give us some ideas for healthy snacks to have in our bags for our kids.
Yes. Well, there you go. That's a big one, because kids do like to graze all day. I just have sometimes plain crackers, maybe the Ryvita crackers. You know, children probably don't like them so much. But even a banana is a good idea, a little easy peeler. I make carrot sticks and hummus. I generally have sort of vegetable sticks in the fridge that the kids can just help themselves to. They're sort of my go-to snacks. I also make sure that they don't fill them up too much before the next mealtime. So now that the kids are a little bit older, I tell them to have a glass of water maybe sometimes, or I get them involved in meal preparation, which obviously at age three, that's more mess than it's worth.
But it's great fun.
Exactly, and they learn something. And, you know, even to get them to peel a carrot or look at a carrot and dip it in a bit of hummus or guacamole, they feel involved and they're not filling up their tummies too much, you know. But yeah, I try to have small snacks and really concentrate on meals.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
A recent EU summit took place in Brussels, and it saw tensions mounting between Poland and Hungary and Northern European nations. It seems that the fund that's being set up to help countries after the pandemic might be conditional. Earlier on in the week, I chatted to economist Professor Ray Kinsella, where he explained exactly what had been happening and indeed what impact this might have on the sovereignty of nations.
Basically, it's an attempt by the EU, particularly the so-called Frugal Four northern countries, Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden and Austria, to make access to the $750 billion pandemic recovery fund conditional on adherence to a so-called rule of law, instead of being based on need and solidarity in the face of the worst crisis in Europe.
And what does that mean? Break that down for me, Ray. The rule of law. What does that refer to?
Well, the first thing to understand is why it's a big deal and what's at stake, Wendy. Two things are at stake. One of them is the pace of recovery from Europe's economic crisis. Now, if you look at the forecast for this year, and you're looking at a really serious situation in terms of debt and particularly in terms of unemployment and growth. So the pace of recovery across Europe is at stake. The other big issue at stake is the viability of the European Union itself in its present form. Now, the likelihood is that there will be some kind of formula to get the EU off a hook of its own making. We'll see that later this afternoon. But really what at stake is something very big. It's a stake, a clash between, on the one hand, what you might call postmodernism in the woke countries of Europe, and the traditionalism, the traditional culture and faith ethos in particularly the Visegrad countries of Hungary and Poland, who have bonded together in this and have said, look, we're not into social engineering. We're into sovereignty, family, identity and nationhood, and we're not about to be bullied.
So this is where the kind of standoff is, right? Does it make you think that the EU has strayed so far from its original purpose in terms of, as you mentioned, their solidarity and as a trading bloc? And is it really the role of the EU to kind of link funds or support to cultural differences?
I think as an economist, it's an outrageous attempt at power politics. And for this reason, what's happened arising from the pandemic, what's happened in individual countries and across Europe is without any kind of precedent. And there is a need for instruments like the pandemic fund and the spending of the budget to counter that. Now, that stands on its own merits, but to link that to an attempt by particularly the Frugal Forum, the Commission, to say, unless you toe the line, unless you accept the whole woke ethos, you won't be getting funding. That's not what the EU was about. When you go back, Wendy, to the foundations of the EU, and I've been reading some of the speeches that Adenauer made in the 1950s. I mean, Christian democracy was what Germany was built on and what Europe was built on. That was the foundations. And that looked at issues like God, like family, like a just economy, like solidarity, subsidiarity. Those were the issues that were living, breathing issues in the 60s and the 1950s. The EU has departed from that and imposed its own social engineering ethos. Now, to me, the most important thing is that if these countries, particularly Poland and Hungary, who have experienced firsthand what Soviet communism means, what it does to people in their homes, what it does to their freedoms to worship, to associate, to freedoms of access to information. Sometimes you feel, Wendy, that you know the woke countries in Europe who embrace cultural Marxism really don't know where it's coming from.
One of the things that kind of is an addendum to that, Ray, is the use of language being used by the EU in referring to things like, for example, to church services at Christmas as ceremonies. Is this a subtle way of trying to eradicate Christian culture?
I don't think it's a subtle way at all. I think it's a very blunt way. And, you know, people need to make up their own mind about this, and they need to look at, for example, what the European Commission in its communique says. I mean, it will not say Christmas. It talks about the winter season, the end of year holiday, the winter period, specific circumstances such as indoor gatherings, indoor festivities. Look, the genesis of Europe is Christian. Christianity has an enormous amount to give to Europe. It's a gift that the foundational fathers gave. It's, by definition, inclusive of everyone. Now, there was a split, maybe in the 1980s, and Europe went one direction, and it became something it was never intended to become. The philosopher Roger Scruton talks a lot about this, and old Europe and new Europe.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
The All-Ireland Hurling Final is, of course, taking place tomorrow in Croke Park. And who will take home the Liam McCarthy Cup? Will it be Limerick or will it be Waterford? Well, that's what I chatted to our GAA analyst Cormac Cahill about yesterday. And we started off just talking about how it's going to be a very different stadium because there's going to be no spectators. And Cormac reflected on that before giving me his predictions.
That is going to be missing, absolutely. There's no homecomings. They won't even be able to bring the cup home. And I suppose I can understand it, you know, because like if Waterford win, they'll go absolutely bananas. There's no doubt about it. It'll be kind of like Mayo in the football, Waterford being the hurling, you know, they'll go absolutely cracked. So I can kind of understand that. But at the end of the day, you know, these things, like this will be spoken of for years to come as the COVID All-Ireland. heard a comment that they still go on about the Thunder and Lightning final, which was, I think, in 1938 or 9 or something like that. That's still referred back to because of the weather conditions that were there at the time, you know. I think it was, I know it was Kilkenny, I know it was the Cork involved as well, I'm not too sure, but this will be remembered for eons as the COVID All-Ireland. I don't think it'll take from the winning of it. I think the Hurling Championship has been fantastic this year, and you know, it's, you're left with the medal and the memories. Okay, they might be a little bit different, but
and on the one hand, Cormac, I guess it's hard to not have supporters and family there, but on the other hand, maybe the players might underestimate what they're actually giving people as in terms of being able to even just sit and watch this, that this is actually happening at all, and to give them that hope, to give them that uplift, to give them that excitement, to give us something to talk about other than COVID.
Absolutely, it's huge, and like the excitement. And I think John Milan, bless John Milan, like, I mean, he's an absolutely fantastic man, you know, he wears passion on his sleeve. And he told a story that I think when he was watching the last match at home with his wife and his two-year-old kid, and after Waterford scored a goal, his wife was so excited that she threw the two-year-old into the Christmas tree, right? Now, he said this himself, so I'm not, you know, this is said in the press, I'm not kind of breaking any trust or gossiping here or anything. He told it himself because, you know, that's funny. But it also, I think, epitomises and demonstrates the excitement that people have at home, you know, that this, like, you can see, and I think the GAA have these ads on for the hurling, and they see the fans at home and going bananas, and I'm one of those, and even from a neutral point of view, when I don't have skin in the game, so to speak, the Cork aren't playing, I get fiercely excited, and as you say, it's a gloomy time of the year. I know we're coming up to Christmas and that's lovely, but you know, you have dank weather, and as you say, the COVID is hanging around in the background all the time, and this is a real kind of, this is like a rainbow, you know, this
is a great way of putting it, Cormac. Is it fair to say that this year's final has a favourite?
I would think Limerick are favourites, but like I would nearly back Waterford.
You're going for the underdog.
Yeah, there's something about the way Waterford are playing. Like Liam Cahill, their manager, he's an ex-squeeze, a Tip man. Like, he's done an awful lot in All-Ireland finals with Tip at minor and under 21 level. So he's as experienced as John Kiely, the Limerick manager. And he's got him playing in such a way, like he made, as I said the last time, he's made a couple of hard calls. But I think Waterford have gone back to, so there's no messing involved, right? He's not tolerating anything but hard work, but he's also leaving him play that kind of, that dashing way that Waterford were known for, that off-the-cuff kind of a play that they do. And I wouldn't back against them. I just have a sneaking suspicion for Waterford. They're both, like, I suppose they're both coming at it from slightly different perspectives. Limerick won it for the first time since 1973 in 2018. What they're trying to do is cement themselves as a great team. But what Waterford are trying to do is, we say, break through the glass ceiling, because they haven't won it in 60 years. So, and I don't think that they're going to, I just have a notion about this team that I think, you know, they sort of slightly sort of misfired in 2008 with that brilliant team against Kilkenny, but that was Kilkenny at their peak. They've beaten Kilkenny on the way to this. They've beaten Cork on the way to this, two of the traditional big powers. They beat Clare as well on the way. They may not get as much kudos for this. And they ran Limerick to 4 points in the Munster final. They have nothing to fear, and I genuinely, when you think the way they played in the second half against Kilkenny the last time was just absolutely outstanding, you know, and I wouldn't back against them.
Oh, there you go. Everyone loves an underdog, don't they? Well, except anybody who's listening to us from Limerick this morning, of course. What about Limerick in terms of why they are such a good team?
Well, I think that, like, they have just a great way about them, you know. They have a half back line and a half forward line. The half back of Burns and Hannon and Kyle Hayes, and the half forward line of Gerard Hegarty, Keane Lynch and Tom Morrissey. They're powerful, big men. They play a kind of a controlled style of hurling, I suppose, in a sense that they try to work it up through the lines. Like, they have Aaron Gillan, who was, you know, a fabulous player. Now, I've heard that Aaron Gillan kind of got heavy knock in the semi-final. He may not be 100%. But I think, you know, they're young, they're bullying for it, they play a great style of hurling, and I think their manager really complements them, you know. And like Limerick, you know, an awful lot of people, when they think Limerick, they think rugby, but an awful lot of Limerick people would say to you that hurling has always been hugely traditionally strong in Limerick, and maybe is overtaking hurling, or maybe is overtaking rugby in recent times as well. So they are really passionate, they're always a sleeping giant, and I think that their style of play, the size of them, they're huge men, their style of play suits the modern game, you know, the way they work it up through lines, everything is kind of rehearsed to an extent. I think they're a fantastic team, they're a real good team, but they don't have, to my way of thinking, they don't have that air of invincibility that we say Kilkenny had in the past. So I don't think the Waterford would be massively intimidated by them. And like, you know, people sort of going about, you know, it's an All-Ireland hurling final, we're really looking forward to it. But I think it's the novel pairing really makes this one something that, like, I'm really looking forward to. Yes, of course, you always look forward to it. But if it was, we say, Kilkenny and Tipperary or Waterford and Tip again, you'd be saying, or sorry, Galway and Tip again, you'd be kind of thinking, yeah, this is great. But Limerick and Waterford is such a unique pairing, and they're both really hungry for it, and I think that's why this is one that I'm really, really looking forward to.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are. No matter what, it's going to be a great match. And of course, you've given us your prediction of Waterford, Cormac, so we'll have to see if you've hit the nail on the head this time. Thanks a million for joining us on the programme today, and enjoy watching the match.
My pleasure. Talk to you again.
That's Cormac Cahill, our GAA analyst. And Waterford versus Limerick takes place this Sunday at Croke Park in Dublin. Throw-in time is 3:30, and of course we wish both teams and all their supporters the very best for a brilliant day of sport.
The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.